Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Hannah Dorr from NASHBE. Welcome to the third webinar in the Housing Tenancy Series. Before we get started, I just want to go over a few logistics with you all. We will be unmuting lines during the question and answer period, so if you do not wish to speak, please press star 6 to mute your line. And please do not put your line on hold, otherwise we will hear your hold music. To participate in polling questions, please exit out of full screen mode, otherwise you will not be able to choose an answer. Please use the chat box on your screen to ask a question or leave a comment. The chat box will also not be seen if you are in full screen mode, so please make sure to exit that. During moderated Q&A, as I mentioned before, you can ask questions verbally. To ask a question, please press star 7 to unmute your line, and when you're complete, when you've completed it, please press star 6 to mute your line again. And with that, I will pass it over to Melanie Brown from CMS.
Thank you, Hannah. I just want to start by welcoming everyone to our third and final Supporting Housing Tenancy webinar. I hope that you guys have found the content and information useful thus far, and we have a great agenda planned for you today. I just want to acknowledge some of our internal CMS team members who've been working as a part of this effort. Karen Yanos, who's the director of the Medicaid IEP office, as well as Mike Smith, who's the director of the Division of Community Systems Transformation, which is the division that is administering the LTSS priority area of IEP. So we do have several speakers for you today. First is Melanie Starnes, who is a consultant from Trueven Health Analytics. We also have Len Kovich with TAC, the Technical Assistance Collaborative, and Steve Eichen, who is also with Trueven Health Analytics. So just to briefly go over the goals for today's call, we are going to follow up on the crosswalk for state strategy development. After that, we will have some time for questions and answers. And then we're going to try and just summarize some examples of state strategies, commonalities, and keys to success. We will have more time for questions and answers, and then we'll discuss next steps. So just to briefly review the goals of the Supporting Housing Tenancy webinar series. During our first webinar, we did provide an overview and description of the housing-related services and Medicaid authorities that may cover some of these services. In our second webinar, we had some great state examples of Medicaid coverage of housing-related services. And today, the focus really is on implementation planning based on lessons learned from states that have had some experience with these issues. So as a couple of folks have already asked in the chat box, and we will, of course, be making the slides and recording for all of the webinars available. I believe that recordings and slides for webinars 1 and 2 are already available on our Medicaid.gov website, and it will probably take a couple of weeks or so, but this webinar recording and slides will be available as well. So the overall goal for this track was to assist states in understanding housing-related activities and services that can help individuals get and sustain affordable and community-integrated housing. We also wanted to assist states with adoption of housing-related services within Medicaid benefits for people who need community-based long-term services and supports. So now I'm going to turn it over to Len, who's going to talk a little bit about using the crosswalk for state strategy development.
Great. Thanks very much, Melanie, and good afternoon to all of you. I can't believe this is our third webinar already. The series really went by pretty quickly. So I want to just do a quick check-in with you on the crosswalk. On webinar 2, Marty Nisley, we spent some time on kind of talking you through and having some examples of a filled out crosswalk to kind of hopefully get you started. And Marty is on the webinar as well in case there are some specific questions. So we have a few more submitted since we finalized the slides for the webinar. Thank you for advancing the slide for me. So as I was saying, we've gotten some crosswalks that we've received so far, and you can see from the slide that, again, I think I've always said that the crosswalk should begin to kind of tell you a story of what's happening in your state. It really is meant to be a tool. It's not going to do the work. It kind of should tell you something in terms of what your gaps are and how you're funding services. So you can see from this slide that there are a variety of funding sources that have been identified by the states that have submitted their crosswalks, and that those areas are the HUD Continuum of Care, state grant funding, no surprise there. A few years ago, we actually did a survey through NASHBID, National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, to try to get a sense of how states were paying for housing services for people living in supportive housing. And by and large, the biggest source of that funding was state grant dollars. Another source, private donations. Money follows the person both through administrative revenues as well as through MFP services themselves. And then for states, the states that submitted the crosswalk, the different program authorities, 1915C, 1915I, targeted case management, and community first choice. So, no, I probably not big surprises there in terms of if a state is using Medicaid, what type of authority they're using currently. So, again, back to the story, if you will, and what the crosswalk is telling you. So for the states that submitted, each state already identified a gap in coverage for at least one type of service and for one population as well. And most of the states, it was really two sources of funding that were providing most of the services for people living in housing in the crosswalk. So we want to do some follow-up on the crosswalk. I think, you know, the crosswalk is a very important tool. It's a very important exercise for you as you begin to kind of plan out your strategies for next steps. Once you have your crosswalk and you see where your gaps are in your services and or your funding. So we are hoping that we will have additional states send in their crosswalks, because what we want to do, as we have said, is group states together to the extent that we can, where we see common themes among the crosswalks that have been submitted. So, for example, states that are targeting similar populations, can we put together a 6 or 7 state call to talk specifically about what comes next? And Truven will be contacting the team lead from each of the states to get that you guys identified when you filled out your expression of interest form to gauge states' interest and availability. I will say this, though. It would be very helpful for us to have more states submit the crosswalk and to have at least started your crosswalk and have a good start on it to be part of these calls, because it's, you know, it's almost you don't know what you don't know until you kind of start filling out the crosswalk, and hoping that you guys aren't overwhelming yourselves with this activity. Try and keep it as simple as you can for that first draft to kind of get stuff on paper. What are you providing? Who's paying for it? What are the populations? What are the different divisions that are involved? It might be helpful to have each office. I know some states have had each office fill it out, so that the office that works with folks with developmental disabilities will fill out one. The office that works with folks with a mental illness will fill out one. The long-term living folks. And then kind of bring it together so that you get a picture across your state human services or however you're organized. But my caution is not to overwhelm yourself and to try and keep it simple as you can as you begin to fill it in. Because, again, to have these calls be meaningful and to have them be for folks to get something out of them, you have to have some level of information provided on the crosswalk to make them meaningful. So with that, we want to do a couple polling questions to see if we could gauge the status of where you guys are. As I said, we only have a handful of crosswalks that were submitted, so we want to get a sense of where you guys are. So the questions you can see, has your agency started working on the crosswalk? Yes, you've completed it. You're working on it. No, our state has not. So if you could take a few minutes now to fill that out. Hannah, is this working?
It seems to be stuck, so we might want to move to the next one.
Okay.
I will try to figure out a solution.
Okay. We'll get that technical difficulty fixed, and in the meantime, let's go to the second one. If you've started your crosswalk, what's been most challenging? Understanding what needs to be done after you filled it out, how to use it, locating your Medicaid and service information, locating your housing information, getting your partners together to discuss it, and finding time to do the work. So if you guys could take a minute now to fill that out. Okay, look, oh no, there it goes again. I'm going to close it in about 10 seconds. Okay, I'm going to close this one so we can take a look at the results. Okay, so looks like the main issue very clearly is folks finding the time to actually set aside to do the work. Second to getting people together, so I'm hoping that means that you've started it and you're having a hard time getting everyone together to discuss it or potentially getting people together to discuss how to approach it. And then less so on locating the information, that's good, and a little bit on how to use it and understanding what needs to be done. Okay, let's move to the next one. And that is, has your state agency started working on the crosswalk? So we're back to, are we back to the first one, Hannah?
Yeah. Yes, we are.
Okay. Okay, let's take about 10 more seconds and then I will close it. Okay, I'm going to close it and let's see what we found. Well, good. So it looks like most of you are working on it. And a good bit of you have actually finished it. A small number have not. Okay. All right. Let's move to the next one. Oh, okay. So we're going to stop here. That's it for the polling questions for the moment. And I want to take a moment to ask if you have any questions for those of you who have started it, or if you haven't, or if you're finished. We have Marty on the line as well, so I want to open it up to see if there's any questions since you started doing the work.
Hi, Lynn. This is Steve Eichen. We do not have any questions in the chat box. If folks want to unmute their line, they can hit *7 and ask a question verbally.
Hey, Lynn, it's Harry. Can you hear me?
I can, Harry, yes.
So I think going through the crosswalk, one of the pieces that I see is that because we are still contract-based, a lot of the information is sort of caught in the contract process. And so I guess I'm just kind of looking at how, if it were Medicaid billable, how this would sort of fall out in terms of, Medicaid covered, how this would actually be different than the current contract process.
So what your crosswalk is, and Marty, jump in as well, but so it seems what your crosswalk is telling you now is that you're funding it through state dollars.
Right.
You're working on implementing your new state plan amendment through the rehab option.
Right.
So if you did it this time next year, you should see that you're covering some of these services through the rehab option through Medicaid, and not solely through your state funding. So you've been able to take advantage of Medicaid and federal financial participation.
Okay. I just want to make sure that is what I was thinking. I just want to make sure that's the route.
Yep.
Hi, Marty.
Hey, Harry. I think the only other thing I would say is that you could still look at your definitions and see and then compare it. I think, obviously, knowing your definition, I think you're, at least on the behavioral health side, I think you're in pretty good shape. But just to double check and make sure, you know, this is something we know can be covered with Medicaid, and, you know, you've been through that exercise already there about what you're going to have to cover with state funding. But you could do a double check on it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We do have a question in the chat box now from Trish Farnham in North Carolina. Our challenge with the crosswalk is that many of the functions are allowable in the current waiver case management function, but were not deliberately integrated into the definition and the rate. And Jessica will be able to get TA on how to do this. Lynn or Marty, I don't know if you have any initial thoughts.
I'm not hearing Lynn. So, yes, I would again go back to your current definition and see what might need to be changed in your contract. And so you would modify maybe what the crosswalk would look like and say, what do we need to modify in our provider contracts? We may want to do either a time study or some kind of exercise to determine if we need a change in the rate. Who's delivering the service? Are the same people delivering? Are they going to be able to meet, say, the Medicaid requirements for provider qualifications? And so you might want to do a modified crosswalk that enables you to get from where you are to where you would want to be to say this is going to be a coverable service. So I'm thinking contract terms, provider qualifications, and then in your case, Trish, you might also want to look at what capacity building do I need to do? as a kind of a the next box, if you will. So I think there's a way to modify your crosswalk to do that. Lynn, I don't know if you had any other ideas on that.
Well, yeah, what I was going to say, Trish, is so it would be helpful. I don't know if you guys have submitted, but it would be helpful. I mean, kind of going right to the question about getting TA on it. It would be helpful if you guys would submit it, because there, you know, we want to see if there are common themes across what the states are working on. So, you know, tweaking a definition, adding, looking at the rate. Those may be good substantive areas that we could concentrate a call on.
Thanks, Trish. That would definitely be. It would be one option for the small group calls that Melanie Brown mentioned we'll do afterwards. And we did have a request to repeat the question. The question is that, you know, the state asking the question noted many functions are allowable in case management, but are not deliberately integrated into the service definition and the service rate. And the question was how to, whether technical assistance is available. And North Carolina is one of the states that submitted the crosswalk, and I think it'll be good to look at it with that in mind, and you know, if states have similar interests, maybe we can get a group of states together in terms of interest in using current services versus identifying new services. Some of the polling questions we're asking today are intended to help us figure out how we can organize states so we have a manageable number with similar challenges, so that we can have productive dialogue.
And I wouldn't be shocked if other states are seeing this, that it's allowable, but it's not. And that's what I kind of was when I started talking around, you know, not really overwhelming yourself with this, but just kind of getting out on paper what you're doing, and then we could figure out what, you know, what some next steps are. Because my gut is that other states are finding this, that they're providing, that what they're providing is allowable, but it's not as specifically written as it can be. So I'm thinking that might be something common, a common theme that we could kind of center a call around.
This is Marty, and I think that for anyone using a current definition and you're looking to see if you could modify that definition, you'd probably be a good candidate for that small group.
And thanks for submitting, Trish. That's great.
Yes, thanks. Any other questions? And again, you can press *7 on your phone to unmute your line and ask a question verbally.
Okay, I'm not seeing anything come up and not hearing anything. So for time, because we have a lot to cover in this particular webinar, I'm going to move to the next slide. So Marty really reviewed these questions with you after her presentation on the last webinar. But, you know, again, once you have your crosswalk in hand, these are the kinds of things that you should be thinking about. You know, does it tell you what it needs to for you to be able to, I mean, ultimately, I think what you guys want to do is be able to use Medicaid authority to provide housing-related supports and services to people living in permanent supportive housing. So does that crosswalk allow you to achieve that purpose? And what do you have to do to achieve that purpose? And I think even before you start the exercise, and I, for those of you who have, and a lot of you have started it, hope that you kind of ask these hard questions. You know, you're going to do this exercise. Are you willing to kind of make the changes that the crosswalk will point out to you. So whatever, you know, whatever that might be, doing a state plan amendment, doing a change in definition, as Marty just said, looking at your provider requirements, looking at your regulations. So have you kind of had those conversations with your leadership, your Medicaid leadership, your behavioral health leadership, your DD leadership, with your, you know, with your governor's office, so that the tool is, it's a meaningful exercise, and it kind of gets you to the place that you want to go. And, you know, understanding who that audience is, who you have to make that presentation to, and, you know, making it understandable for them, not talking in waiver speak, Medicaid speak, but really making them be able to understand what your goals are and what you need to do to accomplish that and get there, which is ultimately having people be stable in housing, which is a good thing for everyone. And then have an idea. What's your timing? These things typically don't go off in the way that you plan. They typically have delay after delay after delay, so you want to try and really think about that and work that into your plan, because delay is inevitable as you try to make these kind of systems changes. And identifying, it's great to identify your champions and your advocates who are going to help you kind of make your case. I also caution to manage those expectations of those stakeholders, and don't let that get ahead of you or in front of you, because you don't want to have to kind of regroup and it's not meeting the needs of where your stakeholders have gone. So it's very important to identify who those folks are. It's also very important to manage what the expectations are as you move this exercise forward. Okay, we have polling question 3 and 4. So based on what you've done so far, to the extent that you can answer this question, do you or does your state intend to add a new tenancy support service, modify an existing authority to pay for the service, both, or you're just not sure? So if you could take a minute to answer this question. Okay, I'll just take a couple more seconds before I close it. Okay, let's see what we got. Not surprising at all. Not certain at this time. So that's fair. That's absolutely fair. So I would, again, encourage states that have not at least taken the first shot at the crosswalk to submit that to us, so that we can figure out some additional calls around additional topics. Okay, and then the final poll for this section will be, what Medicaid authority do you intend to use to pay for the tenancy support services in your state? 1115, the B, the C, the I, community first choice, targeted case management, other, or not certain. So if you could take a few seconds to do this one. Okay, going to close it in just a few seconds. Okay, great. Okay, again, not certain, but a good bit. Do you a good percentage of you do have an idea? Either 1115 or 1959, it looks like. Okay, all right. Thank you all for participating in the poll, and I now am going to turn it over to Melanie Storms.
Hello, everybody. Hope you're having a good week. What we wanted to do with this section of the webinar is to share with you some state strategies, and it's the states that have done work in one section or another around tenancy support services and how they have developed those services in their states, and give you some tidbits, the idea being there may be ideas from a variety of different states that might work for you that you can replicate or amend and replicate, and perhaps by cobbling some various strategies together, it gives you a little head start. And it's always nice, having worked in states for almost 30 years, I know it was always nice to be able to learn from someone else's challenges and to avoid the potholes that they may have found, because I always found plenty of potholes on my own in my own work. So here we're going to present some experience and promising practices and keys to success from several states. And you see the Connecticut, Louisiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. On the last webinar, you heard in depth from Louisiana and about the one program in Massachusetts, and they have again joined us for this webinar. We have staff from the other states who are on the call today, and we thank them very much for joining us. And so if there are questions as we go through this a little later on, then hopefully they will be available to answer such questions. And if not, we'll go ahead and take those and get responses back to you. So there are some sort of key reasons why these states decided to offer tenancy support services. And for Louisiana, Maryland, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, one of their intents was to address homelessness and chronic homelessness in their state. But for those same states, Louisiana, Maryland, Connecticut, and New Jersey, they also were looking to promote community integration and reduce institutionalization. So they have a little more money follows the person kind of work in the Tennessee support stuff, that at least initially in those states. But regardless of the reasons that they started doing this or how they came to Tennessee Support Services and how they're providing them at what looks like in their state, all of the states agreed that there were some partnerships is the key to this. Nobody is doing this by themselves, and obviously that's the reason for this series of webinars and this effort from CMS, is to encourage those partnerships between Medicaid agencies and other entities out there, particularly other service agencies and state housing agencies. But also our experience states that, you know, local direct service providers, and then the landlords and housing developers and their associations, if they exist in your state, are really important partners. They're not probably people that human services and health services typically work with, but are really key to this type of service. And then advocates, the housing advocates, population advocates, not just for homeless, but for all the variety of populations. I know some of the states are looking at a wide variety of populations that they're looking to support with tenancy services, and other states are focusing in on, you know, a single population or two. So having those advocates in play, and I know for Louisiana, those advocates were really key, Robin has said, to helping move their effort forward. Then including people who we use services, Connecticut made a very clear point about this, of making sure that we don't create for people without the people at the table. Those who are going to use the services can help inform us in a way that we don't necessarily know if is sitting in our office. And then champions. And I think oftentimes when we're in state government and we think of champions, we think of people in the governor's office or legislators. But they can also be people from foundation or the advocates who can make the issue known, people from faith groups, et cetera. So people who are willing to be part of the effort, who are going to sing the song from the mountaintop, bring others to the table, help the community believe in what you're doing, and help you in the short and long term move things forward. Okay. So there are some strategies, and I don't know if this is rocket science, but again, that we heard over and over that were important between building partnerships between Medicaid and housing agencies. And one is to hold leadership meetings on a regular basis. And we know that everybody's busy, calendars are crazy, but getting that scheduled and getting it on the calendar for the long term is really a good thing to do. It may be that occasionally you don't need a meeting and you can cancel it. Nobody ever complains about found time, but trying to wedge a meeting in at the last minute is always tough. So get those meetings, hold those meetings, because having that regular contact, that interaction, really helps build the relationships. Establish a common understanding of systems. It's likely that people in housing don't know all the ins and outs of Medicaid, and I would say that it's fair to say that Medicaid and service agencies probably don't know all the ins and outs about housing. And these are two very complex systems with a variety of funding mechanisms and rules and regulations and different federal agencies that they work with. And so that's part of why CMS is really working closely with the housing agencies at the federal level to try to say we need to partner together with this. And having a common understanding of how our systems work is really key to being able to foster the ideas about how we can work together. Of course, setting goals that everybody can support so that we know where we're going and why we're going there and generally how we're going to get there. Encourage open and honest communication, and that includes being able to receive and give feedback and incorporate that feedback. Don't just hear it, but hear it and then say, okay, what do we do with that? Is there a process that we can change? Is there an idea that we can incorporate that, even if it came from an unusual source, that we can still incorporate? And then, you know, lastly, that building trust takes time. And whether it's trust with another state agency or with a housing developer or any partner that you're working with, trust is the outcome of making commitments to each other, consistent follow-through, honest and open communication, and honestly valuing what your partners bring to the table. Because not everybody brings money to the table. Some people bring access. Some people bring political power. Some, you know, folks are going to bring information that can inform your discussions. And so no matter who you are, what you bring to the table is important to the process. Okay? So then there are some strategies to engage housing developers, because they're probably the most unique group out there. We're used to working with human services and healthcare, and housing developers are generally outside of who we work with on a regular basis if we're not already doing tenancy support services. So we asked states, the experienced states, about that, and they shared with us that they might include, in Connecticut and Maryland, for instance, they include the housing developers as part of their tenancy support team, so maybe your IAP team. Most of the states' health developers understand the need for supportive housing and how tenancy support services can stabilize tenancy and reduce turnover. So it's a win-win. What's in it for them? Because ultimately, housing development is a business, and they want to have as few vacancies for as little time as possible. So what can you bring to the table to help make that happen? And that should be of interest to them, as well as what they can bring to the table, which is that housing, which is of interest to you and the people that we're trying to serve. Start with those that you have a good track record with, or they have a strong interest. Don't try to crack the hardest nut first. Go where there is some interest to try to prove the concept and get some folks on board to build that momentum. And if there is no one that's at the table, then Liz Louisiana did. They used tax credits, and they created a monetary incentive that then got the interest of some developers and was able to get the ball rolling that way. Work to establish some flexibility with the developers regarding vacancy churn time, the churn time in the system, so the time from when a person moves out, the time that a new tenant moves in. That's open time that landlords and developers are essentially losing money in their eyes. And so what are the systems that you can put in place that helps developers keep that and landlords be willing to hold that unit open while perhaps there are modifications being made for a person who's transitioning from an institution to this unit, or there are other kinds of things that they need to get in place. And so Connecticut, Maryland, and Louisiana all found ways to satisfy the need to make those modifications and do what was right for their clients, but also satisfy the landlords and the developers in being able to keep those units open longer. And then leverage your relationships with developers and with the public housing authorities to establish set-asides, unit set-asides, vouchers, whatever, to specifically for Medicaid members or low-income folks. And Connecticut, Maryland, and Louisiana all did that very successfully. Okay, strategies to engage housing developers. The point we wanted to make here is that housing and Medicaid agencies can collaborate together. Medicaid can and should be at the table when looking to expand the availability of existing housing units for low-income people. And at the table, even when you're looking in the longer term, about creating new supportive housing units with non-Medicaid funds using state or foundation funding. And so we gave you some examples there. Louisiana has developed over 3,500 units, both developed existing and created new, using a mix of funding sources and leveraging support from their community advocates, sort of their champions. The Maryland Departments of Disability Housing and Medicaid all partnered together to get a Weinberg Foundation capital grant to create about 40 new supportive housing units. So that was a long project, but those three agencies really worked with their community and with developers, and now they have a stronger relationship with developers that will serve them well as they move forward. New Jersey has developed over 3,000 units using state funding that they were able to cobble together. Connecticut and Maryland leveraged their Money Follows the Person funding to create bridge subsidies that helped, again, address that thing about churn and reducing the unit vacancy time, and that made it attractive to landlords to work with them because they would be the cost of, instead of the unit sitting vacant, the cost would be covered while they were helping people transition from institutions. And then Maryland, the Medicaid office, used Money for All the Person resources to hire housing specialists, and they provided money to their Department of Disabilities to hire staff that focused on increasing affordable housing opportunities, specifically for people with disabilities. So there's a variety of strategies. There are lots of different things that you can do, and I encourage you to ask questions and get in touch with these states if you want to learn the nuances about how they did some of these things. Okay, and I am going to turn this piece over now to Steve.
Great. Thanks, Melanie. This is Steve Eichen from Trubin Health, and the next set of slides talks about developing an infrastructure for the tenancy supports. If we move on to the next slide, and I got to just get my mouse to the right spot. There it is. We're looking at infrastructure both at the state and local level, and in some cases you're going to have some intermediary levels, especially managed care organizations, but even there's a lot of state management to make sure that the MCOs are on the same page and helping get the work done. All the states we talked to had active state roles in the processes, managing vacancy lists, authorizing tenancy support services, and authorizing exceptions payments when there's necessary. There's utilization management criteria. Sometimes there are exceptions where, additional funding needs to happen, or, there's kind of exceptions to the usual process, and the state needs to approve those. Connecticut, Louisiana, Massachusetts, and Maryland all mentioned that. New Jersey, as Harry Reyes mentioned earlier, they're not quite into the Medicaid funding yet, but they've already developed a clearinghouse specifically to manage rental subsidies, and they have an Olmstead unit to expedite discharge from hospitals so they can make, there's an active state involvement in identifying the people that need supportive housing and connecting them to the services. Also, Louisiana and Connecticut have special contacts for landlords and developers. So if there are special issues, including after a person is in the housing, if a landlord or a housing owner has a particular concern, they have someone they can contact. Part of that, I think, is the assurance that there is somebody to contact. It helps the houser accept somebody in the first place. It also frankly helps troubleshoot situations when they arise. at the local level, there's the housing and the service providers who are actually on the ground providing the supports that people need. And it says to delivering services to members and landlords. You know, Medicaid technically doesn't deliver services to anyone except the person, but with the tenancy support services, there is a lot of work with the landlords and the housing system. So we put that in there because it's, even though the ultimate goal is serving the person, a lot of the interface is with the landlord as well. In the forthcoming slides, we'll talk about how states improve their infrastructure, training to prepare people to provide tenancy supports, ongoing staff support, and expediting service startup. So the training, and this was a big theme across all the states, training. Really at all levels, direct support staff and their supervisors, service staff in the housing systems, if applicable in your state, service staff to help coordinate the housing and service systems. And if there's supports provided in the housing systems that's Medicaid eligible with a new service, helping them get up to speed and how to do that. Managed care organizations, helping them understand what the service is, helping people access and authorize services when appropriate. Education about, so what do we train people on? What's the content of the training or what kind of training is provided? That's really the middle two bullets there. Education on the type of tenancy support services, what they are in the first place, their role in supportive housing. Training also will establish conceptual buy-in on the value of these services. And practical tools for service delivery. How do you really get this done? And finally, states typically have developed and delivered the training themselves, but some states have used a train-the-trainer approach for ongoing delivery. You know, the initial lift pretty much needs to come from the state, or at least have the state's blessing is what these experienced states have found. But on an ongoing basis, there might be a train-the-trainer approach to reduce the state burden. New Jersey is a really good example on the training front. They've spent years working with providers, helping them get ready for significant system and services changes. Training elements included, they're listed in the bullets on the right, the principles of supportive housing, skill building activities, supervision, documentation, billing, and Medicaid compliance. And also the contract compliance for the contract funding, really a comprehensive training approach. Ongoing staff support, you know, obviously the initial support, the initial training we need to do to get off the ground, but then, of course, it's never really done. It may level off, but it's never really done. The local staff are really the key to success, and there's three tips on this slide in terms of helping that local staff do what they need to do. First, you know, tenant issues can be complex, and people at the local level, they need to be able to access information and get answers quickly. So if they need to contact the state, they need to be able to get a response pretty quickly. And not only, you know, in the middle box, it's not just state staff being responsive to the providers, but also to the housers as well, to landlords and developers. If they have concerns, you know, they ideally would go to the tenancy support staff first, but if they need to get to the state, there are people that they can contact. And finally, tenancy support staff need ongoing training, keep skills up to date, learn new methodologies, and also the opportunity for input. What's working, what's not working. You know, this is applying, you know, some basic quality improvement principles and involving people into maintaining the service and helping it continue to improve to work well for people. Finally, expediting service startup. This is a pretty significant issue, you know, even though, you know, especially when I evaluated the initial nursing home transition grants in the early 2000s, you know, the biggest delays were because of delays in just finding housing. But once you found that housing, the transition coordinators really had to hustle to get the services in place. So it was really a hurry-up-and-wait kind of situation, or a wait-and-hurry-up situation, if you will. So the successful state agencies are integrally involved in the daily processes. And, you know, it never ends, right? And this is a good point to just note that it's really a high-touch, high-reward type of supports. And it is, I want to emphasize the high reward at this point, because the benefit of getting people into independent housing and helping them stay there, in terms of individual outcomes, in terms of cost savings for the healthcare system, the benefit is tremendous. So when I look at these slides, it looks like a lot of work. And, you know, I think back to when I wore the state hat, and it seems like a lot of work, but it also seems worth it. And it's a good point to kind of mention that, because that's going to be a really significant value as we look at implementing these services. In terms of particular steps that states took to expedite the service startup process, closely monitoring vacancy lists and tenant readiness frequently, daily or weekly monitoring at the state level. Who's ready? Who has homes? You know, where are vacancies appearing, and who's ready to go to that area? Who would choose that housing? There's still an active state level management there. Identifying people early in the process to provide more time to prepare them for the move. Ensuring timeliness of eligibility and service authorizations. And this was something Louisiana, Connecticut, and Maryland all mentioned. Depending on the program authority and the state rules, there can be a lot of steps to get people in service. There may need to be some adjustments or some steps to take to make the process move more quickly for people who need the tenancy supports to get people into housing. Also, vacancy payments. Connecticut and Louisiana authorize vacancy payments, which is a nice cushion in case the startup isn't as expedited as we'd like. Connecticut allows 15 days typically, but up to 60 days when there's a home modification necessary. Louisiana will pay up to 80% of the rent for 2 months, so about 60 days. Other tips, a tracking system, automated for efficiency, just maintaining the state data, make it easier to find, to monitor people's progress, find out who's available, who's moved. Ongoing formal meetings as well as informal communication are key. Goes back to Melanie's point about the partnerships and keeping those partnerships moving and having a structure, both a formal structure and the informal structure. Also, a designated point of contact for developers and landlords. I mentioned this a couple minutes ago, and the four states mentioned here, Connecticut, Maryland, Louisiana, New Jersey. All four of those states mentioned having this designated point of contact. And it's helpful in general, but also particularly helpful in terms of service startup, in terms of making sure you get access to the house. So if you need to do things for the move-in, like get furniture in there before the person comes, then you can do that. Making sure that everything works smoothly. Now I'm going to hand it off to Lynn Kovitz. Lynn, you might still be on mute.
Yes, I was. Sorry. Okay. So I'm going to cover the next few slides talking about provider capacity and billing, very big issues as you move to more of a system of Medicaid. So strategies that states have used to expand their provider pool. So you can see this nice little chart that kind of talks about the different strategies and which states have implemented those. And I think one of the takeaway for this particular slide, so for the first bullet, incorporate TSS into existing contracts and provide necessary training. So you can see four of the states have done that. And, interestingly, and when I was still in New Jersey, when we were kind of gearing up to do some of this, we would, have conversations with the providers about the training that was coming, and many of the providers, good providers, but many of them thought they were providing the services we were intending in the change. And come to find out as we began to roll out the training, which was pretty intensive, the light kind of went on and they realized, no, this is really not the service that we're providing now. This is a far different service. And, the training was just so helpful. So Maryland established the tenancy support service as a separate service within a Medicaid authority. So very clearly identified the service within a specific Medicaid authority. Now, Connecticut and New Jersey as well trained existing housing staff, so expanded the provider pool without bringing in new providers by training, again, that very intensive level of training for their existing providers, not kind of bringing in new providers, but really concentrating and training staff, doing that kind of skill transition in the same way we would be doing that in skill building exercises with the folks that we're working with, but kind of building those skills up with not only the folks who are providing the direct service, but also the supervision and understanding how to supervise someone who is providing this new kind of service. So that training is really very important from a number of levels. Matt, now, allowing MCOs to bill or larger Medicaid providers to serve as billing agents for small direct service TSS providers. And that, I think you'll find as, there are housing agencies or emergency shelters may not really be equipped to have that infrastructure to do the Medicaid billing. And so very important to allow that kind of flexibility within the system, because they likely know the residents best, they know the services to provide, but just don't have that infrastructure to bill. So that's an important tool to have and to use. Reach out to your strongest providers first. I think you all know really who your kind of go-to providers are, who get the service, who understand the service, who kind of live it and breathe it, and really having them kind of, as Melanie talked about in earlier slides, that your champion or your advocate to kind of move the system in this way. And I'm sure there are a number of providers that you could kind of point to pretty quickly to be able to reach out to first. And then you really want to make sure that the service is being provided in the way that you intend. So really having good standards, good regulations, so that the service that you're expecting is being provided, and there are standards to measure that against. Now, as you're doing this, you'll find that not all the providers are going to meet the standards or wish to participate, and that can be okay. You see, Louisiana only has 14 providers that provide tenancy support services across the state. Now, you want to make sure that you have a good provider pool, but sometimes it might be better to have a smaller number of providers who do the service very well and can handle, the numbers of folks to be served, as opposed to having it so dispersed and kind of losing control of that quality. And again, you see Massachusetts using its regional managed care companies to be those billing agents for the smaller agencies, so that they can provide the service, but don't have to have the infrastructure for the billing. Now, Maryland did increase its providers. So, you know, they went from 20 to 24 as they combined two of their waivers and incorporated tenancy support services into those waivers. So every state is different, and it just depends on your own circumstances, sometimes your own geography, your budget situation, and how you want to roll this stuff out. Okay, this is probably one of your more, I don't know if the controversial is the right word, but definitely one of the more difficult exercises that you might go through as you begin to develop these services. It's very, very important that the rate is right, that the service, that the providers can provide the service in the way that the state rolls it out and the state defines it in its state plan with adequate supervision. So that rate setting strategy is very, very important to land on a rate that is going to be appropriate for the service that the state wants to provide. So New Jersey went through a very intensive rate setting process and then tested it. So spent a lot of time on a provider survey. So providers really did a time study of the amount of time they spent in face-to-face time, in other kinds of non-face-to-face activities to really get a sense of, are these the right rates? Are people spending enough time in face-to-face time? Now, Maryland incorporated its tenancy support service within an existing service at the same rate. So that is certainly an option as well. Louisiana, different. They incorporated their tenancy support service into an existing service at an enhanced rate. And they assume less face-to-face time. I think in New Jersey we were assuming more face-to-face time. So just, again, all different state circumstances. Louisiana also created, and Robin talked about this on the last webinar, a standalone service for billing for both face-to-face time and indirect through their 1915C. Now, that approach is not really allowed under some authority, so you have to make sure you're following the rules and regs of the different authorities that you're using. And Massachusetts established a per diem. Their program is within an 1115, so they have some flexibility to test out different kinds of payment structures. And I think if you asked a provider would always say that the case rate is really the way to go, but, you know, it takes some time to be able to get to that case rate. You have to have the data to kind of support what is built, what will eventually build that case rate. So you're also, I think you will find that some of your providers may not be able to have the capacity to bill for Medicaid services for, you know, many of the reasons that you see on this particular slide. So, you know, you have to have a certain level of staff with a certain level of knowledge. You have to have some license and some credentialed staff, perhaps. You have to have adequate infrastructure, adequate technology to be able to bill and to track the Medicaid dollars. Some providers, if they're small, may not have, if they're living on a fee-for-service environment and they're billing as they go, if they're not providing a volume of service, they may have cash flow issues and may not be able to make it in this environment. Or just developing the Medicaid billing capacity just is too cost prohibitive for some of the smaller agencies. So in order to combat some of this and deal with some of this, Louisiana, New Jersey, Connecticut both provided one-time and kind of ongoing support to train providers to develop their capacity to bill Medicaid, because there's all different facets once you begin to bill Medicaid. There really needs to be an emphasis on compliance, ensuring that what you are billing you can back up with your documentation, a lot of supervision, a lot of checks and balances, and the technology to a software system that allows states to do that. So I think there will be some limits, perhaps, with some of the agencies And there may be some ways to address that and to deal with that. So you saw on a previous slide that Massachusetts allows some of its larger providers to really submit the bills on behalf of the smaller service providers, because they just will never have the infrastructure or the ability to bill. It's in some ways it's like a chicken and an egg, because to be able to bill Medicaid, you have to have some volume of service, so you have to grow, but you don't really have the dollars, the kind of capital to start up, so you're kind of spinning because you kind of have to spend money to make money and you don't always have that money. So it's a conundrum, I think, for our smaller agencies. So in Massachusetts' case, allowing the larger providers to bill is a really good example of how to keep smaller providers in the network and able to provide the services that they're probably very good at providing. And some states have used a higher rate to start, so you build up the rate to account and allow the provider to build up some of this infrastructure. And then as the years progress, in second or third year, you begin to bring that rate back in line with the other rates of other more established kinds of providers. You might also, as a state, allow some one-time funding. So in states that are still in contracts, at times when states aren't spending their entire contracts, allowing them to use some of those one-times for some infrastructure expenditures or purchases. So there's some ways to help providers really begin to think about being able to be a Medicaid provider. And, you know, as we continue to really work with Medicaid and have these services be provided through a Medicaid authority, I think that this is something that states will be working on very, very closely. Okay, and at this point, I'm going to pass it back to Melanie.
Sorry, I tried to get myself off mute there. Okay, so I just wanted to touch base on, go back to slide 38 for a minute, and just mention to you that that Louisiana did establish Tennessee Support Services within the Medicaid authority. So we'll make sure that is reflected. This may be the wrong slide, but it's reflected correctly, but that is something that I think Louisiana is known for, and I think we missed a check mark on one of our boxes. So we'll make sure to get that on the slides that are posted so that you have absolutely correct information once they go through, once they're available to you online. Anything else we need to share about that, Robin? Okay. All right, so if we go to one of the things that we had heard earlier on in our in the first webinar were questions about outcomes and certainly lessons learned. And so we wanted to share with you some of the outcomes that the experienced states felt were really key for them, that they were very useful. We asked them, would you use these measurements again if you had it to do over again? And they all said yes. And so we wanted to just share what those ideas were with you, because I think having a good outcome measure, you know, you can really helps to tell the story, helps you figure out what is what's working, what's not, helps you identify where changes are needed, and also can help you in telling that story to leverage additional resources and support. So for Louisiana, they had two that they were doing. They have probably the most complete system, so Tennessee Support. So they looked at tenancy retention, so how long is a person remaining in their housing, the supportive housing situation, and looking at the duration of that, and then also their increase in household income. So these were two that were very key for Louisiana that they would absolutely use again. Massachusetts, remember, they were, focusing on homelessness and people with mental illnesses. They were looking at a decrease in emergency department visits. So once they had their supportive housing, once that was stabilized, did that have an impact on emergency room visits? And then in Connecticut, they made a note to say that they really conduct a cost-benefit analysis every year. So they're looking at how much it costs and what those costs would be otherwise without the supportive housing, without the tenancy support services, and they're able to, for that return on investment that some of you had asked about early on. And then in New Jersey, they're looking at the decrease in the state hospital census and what are the tenancy supports, again, providing a stabilizing force in these members' lives so that they are not in and out of the institution. Okay. Now let's just kind of get into three slides here for lessons learned and then some keys to success. So all the states agreed that broad partnerships with entities at all levels of the process are essential. We talked about that before. And that you should, you know, choose your partners thoughtfully and include the service recipients, include the public, include the advocates in that process. You may have a core team that's smaller and more nimble and that is like a steering committee, and that makes some sense. But as you look at the broader team where you're trying to develop these resources in the community, make sure that you are not just staying with state agencies, but that you broaden that out and you have a really good set of input, and then you have a good set of people working on your behalf for you. Develop the common goals that everybody can support. Gain buy-in from the housing developers, providers, landlords early on in the process, if that's possible. At least keep knocking at their door and trying to get them engaged so that it's not like you have developed all this and then come and want to sort of lay it on their doorstep. They're going to be less, as all of us would be, less inclined to hug you for it than if they know it's coming and they have been part of the helping to shape these ideas. And then consistent and timely follow through with your commitments and being able to fill those vacant units when they're open does help to build trust with the developers and landlords. Okay. State leadership buy-in is essential for long-term success. There is a reality in state government. You do need the leadership for Medicaid and housing, governor's office, if you have policy advisors involved or legislative liaisons or legislators themselves. Those things are helpful because you want this work. These are systems change things. Systems changes don't often just happen within a year or so. It has an impact that is ongoing. You need to have that long-term buy-in and understanding so that the efforts can weather transitions in personnel and transitions even in administration. Develop champions. This is something we talked about earlier, and those champions can be from all sorts of places throughout the community. Ensure your timeline is appropriate for regulatory licensing and policy changes and just the timeline in general. And in New Jersey can speak to the fact that they got caught up in some changes in regulations, and I know in some states some governors come in and they put moratoriums on developing new regulations and things like that, so you have to anticipate some of that stuff in your planning. And then this is a great thing. Have a go-to person for each key partner agency on speed dial. And we kind of laughed when this was said, and the folks were like, no, we're serious. Have somebody on speed dial so somebody you can talk honestly to, that you can share and receive feedback from, because developing those relationships is really key to when you're trying to, you know, really wrestle with something more difficult later on. So some other lessons are collect, analyze, and use data to show the value of your service and identify opportunities for improvement. So as difficult sometimes as data is to get and to manage and analyze, it is really worth the effort. It is the way you tell your story and can kind of prove that things are working, or you can see quite technically where perhaps it's not working and what needs to be changed. Be prepared to, you know, for considerable provider concerns and allowing time to manage that process. Maybe you don't have leader folks who want to jump on board right away, and it can take some time to develop your partners out there. Louisiana suggests if you create tenancy supports, if possible, to create tenancy supports as its own service with its own set of procedure codes, its own rate, and its own provider qualifications. They found that easier to do than having it woven throughout a bunch of other things. And then matching data across Medicaid and homeless management information systems can help identify and address tenancy-related barriers. And Connecticut has done a lot of work in this arena. So if you're interested and want to learn more about it, the folks from Connecticut are the ones to talk to about that. And they've worked, Connecticut has worked a lot with their university to help them do that. So, again, another resource you may not be thinking about, but everybody has their own universities and colleges that they're working with. Okay. So some common keys to success when developing tenancy support services, they noted the strong partnerships, open and honest communication, flexibility, that's really a key. Not everything, as Lynn said, is going to go the way you plan, no matter how well you've planned, and so being flexible, having not only a plan B, but maybe a plan C and a plan D as well. An integrated funding strategy, one thing isn't going to do it all for you if you're going to serve multiple populations. Getting that housing developers buy-in, landlords buy-in, really important. Provide that training, support those providers, help them get to where you need to be, you need them to be, and plan to do that. Expediting placement, keeping those housing units filled, really a key thing to working well with the housing industry and having them as a happy partner for you. And then really you want to be able to show your success and show the value of these tenancy support services so that you can, you know, continue to gain support, political support, provider and developer support as well. Okay. And with that, I will turn it back to Steve.
Great. Thanks, Melanie. We have a few questions in the chat room. John Randazzo asked how involved HUD is in the process and if there's a go-to person in HUD for technical assistance questions, especially a question regarding waiting list preferences. Melanie Brown, I wonder if you could speak to the partnership between CMS and HUD and others.
Sure, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So HUD is one of our federal partners who is, one, contributing to the program support resources that are available through the IAP effort. They've also been intensively involved in the development of the curriculum that guides the program support and technical assistance that we're offering. So we participate in weekly meetings with representatives from HUD to just talk through whether or not this is the appropriate curriculum to make sure that we're all on the same page. I think the best way for us to get questions to the appropriate HUD person would be for you to, if you have specific questions, to submit your questions through the technical assistance email account that Truven set up. And then we will route it to the appropriate HUD person. So I know that you said it's regarding preferences or waiting list preferences. If you could just give us a little bit more information so we can figure out who would be the best person to respond to that.
Thanks, Melanie. Next question from Betsy Benito. Since only one state highlighted reaching out to the strongest providers first, how did others roll out the supports to a whole set of agencies that presumably, have different performance standards? So I think I'll kind of pitch this to our state colleagues on the line, but I think the point was more around the provider agencies being stronger, not necessarily different standards, but would any of our colleagues from Louisiana or New Jersey or Connecticut or Massachusetts or Maryland want to weigh in on that topic?
Steve, I'm sorry. This is Harry from New Jersey. And so how we decide, we looked at our current supportive housing providers, which is a small group of about 50 providers who, through RFPs, receive services and slot subsidies based on a specific initiative, individuals who have medical issues or have enhanced case management needs or have a IDD/MI serve that population or serve a forensic population. We took a survey of this group of supportive housing providers, anticipated or kind of trying to find out how many direct care staff they had. So as the rehab portion of our SPA was approved, we then came up with a training mechanism through our School of Health-Related Professions through Rutgers to sort of have an idea of how many individuals through these agencies that do our supportive housing work would need to be trained on rehabilitative practices. And that came back at about 800 direct care staff number plus supervisors. And then we sort of wrapped our training around that those individual agencies that are doing our supportive housing provider services, and that's the group that we chose. Does that sort of answer that question?
I think it does. Thanks. Other thoughts? And we could open this up to other states if there's other states that have experience here. And you can hit *7 to unmute your line. Not hearing anything, so I think we'll move on to the next question from Jake Reuter in North Dakota. Do you have examples of training curriculum available for review? We do not, but I don't know if there are states on the line who are willing to share their curricula.
Steve, this is Robin with Louisiana. We'd be happy to share our curriculum.
And Robin, is it on your PSH program website? Because we're actually going to be sending that out as part of our fact sheet.
I don't think it is, but we could see about posting it there.
Okay. I mean, it's up to you. I just thought if it would save you a step, it'd save you a step.
Yeah, we should probably do that.
Okay.
I don't know if this is going. I don't know if there's anybody from Connecticut on the line. But they had indicated that that was something that they could share as well.
So I think Melanie Stearns, we can raise that to them offline and see if it's something we can share with the group somehow.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So Ken Edminster from North Carolina, can the provider surveys be shared so that we can get an idea of how to set one in North Carolina? And I think, Harry, I think this refers to the provider survey that you all did in New Jersey or around the time. I think this came around, right around we were talking about rate setting and the time study that you did.
Sure. We can share whatever we have here. That'd be fine.
Thanks. Melody Pizzolt, is it possible to get a copy of the Massachusetts per diem case rate information? I know, I think Amelia Dunham is the person we have from Massachusetts on the line. I don't know, Amelia, if we need to take this back to others or if this is something that you could respond to now. And Amelia, you can press *7 to unmute your line. So you may have had to log off. So I think we'll raise that topic to Massachusetts offline. Question from Liz Buck. What do you mean in Louisiana by using it as its own service? And could you describe that in more detail? I'll take a shot, and then Robin, I think you can elaborate on that as well.
Sure.
In webinar two, we talked about Louisiana's 1915C waivers, and the 1915C program includes multiple services, and Louisiana added services, I think there were two, specifically for this type of support. So it was an existing Medicaid authority, but it was a new service. And those services were specific to tenancy reports, the rate supports, the provider standards and rate assumptions were specific to that sort of support. Robin, would you like to add more?
No, that's correct, Steve. The reason that we technically it's two services is that one is tenancy supports in either a crisis or during the initial phases of tenancy. And the reason we did that as a service is that for each of the services we define within the waiver, we have to attach a procedure code, and we wanted to be able to authorize those services at a higher level since those are the times when people really need access to more tenancy support services. The second service definition and procedure code is once people are moved in and they're in a maintenance mode. And so that is authorized at a somewhat lower level, but it is a specific, its own service under the 1915C waivers, which is sort of the beauty of what you can do under those waivers.
Thanks, Robin. Another question for you, Robin. What is the eligibility criteria to receive tenancy support services?
Well, the eligibility criteria to participate in our permanent supportive housing program is that a member of the household must have a significant long-term disability. Now, once you meet that qualification and you're in the program, then how your services get paid for depends on which program within that you qualified for, because we don't just rely on Medicaid to cover the tenancy support services. We have some individuals in the program with HIV, for instance, that are covered using Ryan White funds for their tenancy support services. So it's kind of you have to meet that sort of basic PSH threshold, and then your services funding it'll be mental health rehab if you qualify for mental health rehab services, if you have a serious mental illness, and the criteria for that particular program in Louisiana have to do with your score on the LOCUS assessment. You'll have your tenancy supports covered under one of our HCBS waivers if you have a developmental disability or a physical disability that meets the criteria for those HCBS waivers. I'm sorry, it's not a simple answer. There's those program complexities, but that's basically how it works.
Thanks, Robin. Next question would go to all of our states, I think, from Betsy Aiello in Nevada. Do you have information on or are able to share the tenancy support services training programs or modules? Are there train-the-trainer programs? Now, I know Robin from Louisiana, you already said that you can share your training curriculum, and Connecticut mentioned that offline to us as well. I don't know if other states have curriculum or modules that are shareable?
So this is Jersey. I will look at our agreement with Rutgers School to see if we can share that curriculum.
Thanks, Harry.
This is John from Maryland. We have a case manager training manual that is available online through our website. We also have a tenant manual that we give to tenants that goes over, issues related to having your own unit and how to be a good tenant and those types of things. And they're both available on our website, which I can send the URL to the presenter communication chat feature.
Great. Thanks, John. Next question from Rebecca Malange from Minnesota. Are there national resources that can help to build provider capacity regarding billing Medicaid? I am not aware of national resources, but I kind of want to turn to the states or to CMS as well in terms of resources for getting providers up to speed in billing Medicaid.
Steve, this is Robin, and I'll volunteer that I think a lot of times the intricacies of billing Medicaid are state-specific. Like in Louisiana, we have particular claims processes on the fee-for-service side, and then our managed care organizations each have their own requirements around prior authorization and billing. So that's just what I would volunteer from my perspective.
Thanks.
And Steve, this is Lynn Kovic. So in New Jersey, we, and Robin's right, a lot of this is very state specific, but
we took advantage of BH Business that came through the National Council. I believe it was funded by SAMHSA. And it was high level kinds of technical assistance and training. And there were, you know, three or four different modules that I won't remember as I'm sitting here today, but there were, it was a series of vote. I think it went through a couple months. It was all web-based, but we were able to apply, and we usually had groups of, you know, 20, 30 providers that were going through the training at the same time. And I think we had, my goodness, probably about three or four rounds of it, that at least it began to introduce the concept and to have agencies begin thinking about the kinds of changes that they would have to make to begin to be a Medicaid provider. And also, I don't want to keep speaking for New Jersey, but I would just offer this final thing. As agencies are beginning to apply to become a Medicaid provider, Molina, which is the entity in Medicaid, would provide training to providers to kind of get up and running. We used to have them come to some of our provider meetings to kind of give overviews to providers around the nuances of becoming a Medicaid provider.
So, Lynn, this is Harry. Thank you so much for bringing up BH Business. That really was a turning point for many agencies. The three models or modules that they used in New Jersey was changing your business model, third-party billing, and contract negotiation. They were 12-week training, and there was one face-to-face coaching allowed through the BH Business contract that allowed that coach to then come in and meet with those agencies. But that really was a good part of how agencies started to look at not just Medicaid billing, but how they were also going to try to survive in a fee-for-service world and just trying to understand how their billing business models were needing to change. And that was, in fact, we have just offered it again to all of the providers one more time in the event that they feel that there's interest in going through these modules again.
Thanks, Lynn, and thanks, Harry. Another question from Jake Reuter. Has any state attempted to provide tenancy supports across disability populations using a 1959 state plan amendment? I believe that it's not been attempted yet, but I don't know if others from CMS or if there are any state out there that has submitted or is working on such an application. I'm not hearing anything, so I'm thinking that would be pretty exciting. I would think we would have heard about that one. And last question we have in the chat function to date from Marcella Starr in California. What waiver are those services offered? And I know this question came up when Louisiana was discussing the 1915C waivers. There are multiple waivers serving older adults and people with disabilities and people with developmental disabilities. We'll have an example in the fact sheet that we will send probably early next month, early in May, a fact sheet on Louisiana. We'll have a link to the waiver on Medicaid.gov and how you can get to it. I think the specific example I have in mind is if you go on Medicaid.gov and where the waivers are, it's Louisiana Community Choices. Robin, did you have other examples?
Yes, it's the Community Choices Waiver for the aged disabled population in Louisiana. On the DD side, it's the New Opportunities Waiver, the Residential Options Waiver, the Supports Waiver, and I think I'm blanking on one of them. And then, of course, we have also used 1915I authority for the mental health population.
Great, thanks.
Hi, this is Urshal. I just had one quick question. So those tenancy supports, did you include those on all of those waivers that you just stated?
We did. We did. We
okay.
Initially, for all the 1915C waivers, not for 1915I. It was a different approach with 1915I.
Okay. Well, that's great to know because we're just kind of doing a whole bunch of stuff with our new that we're just kind of sending out our new 1115 waiver, and that would be really great to have really specific Medicaid codes for that. So thank you.
Right. Well, I'd be happy to share the service definitions, and I would also be happy to share with you the edits I would make to the service definitions.
You know, I would really appreciate
today.
That. That would be great.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Sure. Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Rochella, for following up. You know, we have covered all the questions in the chat function. I don't know, are there any questions people have verbally? You can press *7 to unmute your line. I don't hear anything, so I think we're going to move on. We have a couple more polling questions for you all. Now, this question, and I am not seeing the full question on my screen. Maybe some of you are on yours, but this question is to inform our future planning for future years of IEP. We may or may not have additional webinars in this series, but we want to get thoughts on what might be helpful if we have future webinar sessions. So this question is, would you attend future webinar sessions on specific housing-related services and partnerships topics and select all topics of interest, going from top to bottom, increasing provider capacity, preparing providers for Medicaid, expanding housing partnerships, working with housing developers, training service coordinators on TSS, rate setting for TSS, measuring cost savings or return on investment, measuring outcomes, ensuring prompt start of service, data management, and data integration. We'll give folks a little bit of time. See quite a few entries already. We'll stop in 10 seconds. Looks got a few stragglers. And I'll close the poll. Very strong interest in increasing provider capacity and in training in measuring outcomes. Lots of interest across the board, but those two really jumped out, preparing providers for Medicaid, expanding housing partnerships, a lot of interest across the board. Let's move on to next steps in general. So this is the last webinar in the webinar series. You know, in terms of additional next steps to close out the series, we're going to post fact sheets for the two states that graciously presented in March, Louisiana and Massachusetts. We've developed fact sheets so that you have something handy. It's one page front and back. You can print it out, share it to people at meetings, give it to decision makers. It's a pretty handy document, and that will be coming to you in early May. We'll post it on the IAP website on Medicaid.gov. The recordings of the first two webinars, the slides, the transcript, those are already available on Medicaid.gov. In May, we will contact the team leads from each state. You know, when you submitted the expression of interest, there was a team lead. We'll contact those individuals regarding interest in small group calls specifically around completing and using a crosswalk. So look forward to hearing from myself or one of my colleagues or the IEP LTSS email from Troop and Health. We will be in touch with you all in early May to schedule some time. As Lynn mentioned before, we plan to group states based on similar interests or needs. We may survey you as well through the email. We've got a lot of information polling questions as well. So look forward to that. If you have questions about the information presented here, including for the HUD waiting list question that was mentioned earlier, please let me know. My email is in the slide deck there, steve.eichen@truvenhealth.com. Include the subject line tenancy. The two final polling questions are to inform the evaluation of IEP. And they actually match questions that we asked in the first webinar. So kind of early in the first webinar, we asked these questions. We're going to ask them again and get a sense of kind of the change in learning over the course of the series. The first question is, I understand what housing-related services are allowable under Medicaid, and indicate whether you agree with this question or not. The options are strongly agree, neither agree nor disagree, or strongly disagree. Looks like our responses have dropped off, so we'll close the poll in about 10 seconds. All right, and we'll close the poll. General agreement, a few strong agree, or neither agree nor disagree. Next one is, my state has the information necessary to create a strategy to implement housing-related services in its Medicaid program. Again, select one for strongly agree, two for agree, three, the third option for neither agree nor disagree, second to last for disagree, or the bottom option for strongly disagree. And again, it looks like responses are slowing, so we'll close the poll in about 10 seconds. And we'll close the poll now. Thank you very much. And we have a fair amount of neutral responses here, a fair number of agreement responses, but also a fair amount of neither agree nor disagree. And just wanted to hand it over to Melanie Brown for some final words.
Thank you, Steve. I just want to thank all of the states that have participated in this learning web series on supporting housing tenancy. I think the polls reflected that most of you were able to move the needle, and we were excited to see that. As I'm sort of thinking through next steps, I just want to go back and reiterate that there is an opportunity for some small group learning sessions. We are still in the process of identifying the topic areas for some of those sessions. That's why you saw some of the polling questions earlier asked whether or not you would attend a small group learning sessions in specific areas. So if you have some thoughts or there were some content areas that you didn't see reflected there that you think would be really helpful, you can still feel free to reach out to us and let us know. We're still very much in the formulation stage of that. We also want to thank the states who provided sort of a case study and shared their experiences and knowledge with us both during webinar two and webinar three. We thank you for being willing to spend time with us and to discuss your experience. And finally, I do want to thank all of our contractor staff. Really appreciate all of the effort and work that's gone into developing the web series. And we're excited that we seem to have been able to help states move closer towards their goals. So I'm not seeing any further questions in the chat box. I'm just doing a last check. So it looks like we're going to go ahead and conclude a little bit early. Again, thank you for your time, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you.